Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 071473, Sheet Metal Workers International Association, Local 270 AFL-CIO Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Case number 081009, Carpenters District Council of Kansas City and Vicinity Locals 311, affiliated with United Brotherhood of Carpenters et al. And Vicinity Locals 978, affiliated with United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America Petitioners versus National Labor Relations Board. Issue 1, standing in the merits of the board's oil capital rule. Mr. Anderson, for the petitioner, Sheet Metal Workers Union. Mr. Stapp, for the petitioner, Carpenters District Council. Mr. Walza, for the respondent, NLRB. Mr. Baskin, for the interveners, Oil Capital Sheet Metal et al.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judge Rogers, and may it please the court. I'm Michael Anderson for Sheet Metal Workers Local 270. I'll touch briefly on the standing issue. We provided the court with the Second Circuit's minute order denying the NLRB's motion to dismiss, which is substantially identical to the motion it makes here. That order is certainly not binding on this court, but it is persuasive, in large part because the Second Circuit relied on D.C. Circuit case law, particularly the oil, chemical, and atomic workers case from 1982. The reason why the Second Circuit was right is that the amount of back pay is not really at issue in this petition. What is at issue is the fact that in the sheet metal workers case, Michael Couch has not been instated in the manner that the administrative law judge recommended that he be. The administrative law judge said that Mr. Couch was entitled to his job immediately and without conditions. But the board order said, no, he will not be instated until he goes through a compliance proceeding, at which time he will bear the burden of proving that he would have remained on the job for 10 full years. And if he can't prove that, then he's not entitled to that job. And under the oil, chemical, and atomic workers case, that means that Mr. Couch did not get what he was asking for. He did not get what the ALJ ordered. And unless the court has further questions about our standing, I'll proceed to the merits.
Well, I think of it as more ripeness, to be honest.
Or a grievement, yes, that's right.
Your problem. And I guess it seems to me, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Tualatin,
yes.
Tualatin Electric, suggests pretty strongly that it is an issue that is best deferred to the completion of the compliance proceedings.
But, Your Honor, I don't recall that in Tualatin there was any delay in the instatement of the employees. The only delay was in the calculation of the back pay. That was certainly the case in the Fourth Circuit case, Anico.
Why is that controlling?
Well, it makes a...
Let me put my problem with it more clearly. You're talking about essentially a procedural aspect of the, what appears to be a procedural aspect of the compliance proceeding itself. And we don't know how that procedural change will play out, or change from prior assumption at any rate. So it would seem, and it's particularly acute in view of your strong argument that it will force the union to disclose all kinds of private information, which we don't know.
Well, but that will be an irreparable harm if we have to wait until the conclusion of the compliance proceedings, because then the cat will already be out of the bag. The union will have already been compelled to disclose everything the board says must be disclosed in that proceeding.
Well, no, I mean, I take it the union could take the position that it's improper for the board to suggest that it disclose this information, and then the issue would be teed up properly for appeal.
Yes, but that was also true in the oil, chemical, and atomic workers case. In that case, the union filed a charge demanding that the employer turn over information. And the board, instead of ordering an immediate duty to turn the information over, said that the union might be able to get it if it went through further bargaining. And the course you suggest would have been equally available to the union in that case as well. But this court held that the union was immediately aggrieved because it didn't get the unconditional immediate relief that it sought.
How do we know the union had any organizing plans? What evidence is there that the union did?
Michael Couch was a union adherent and a union organizer. That was developed at trial on the merits.
No, but what strategies and plans? Suppose that the union people simply got together and they said, look, we're going to get you in there, and we want you to mount an organizing campaign. What's going to happen later? We'll work that out sometime in the future. We're just not worried about that right now.
Yeah, that's often what would happen. But what under the board's new rule?
To follow through, you say that the board is now requiring the union to disclose, in order to prevail on the back pay issues, disclose its plans and organizing strategies. And all I'm suggesting to you is maybe the union didn't have any. How do we know that it did?
But in any event, the employer finds out the extent of that, the presence or absence of those plans by...
The absence of a plan can't be... You claim it's trade secrets. The absence of a trade secret doesn't equal a trade secret, right?
Well, it does in the sense that the employer knows that the union has less of a developed strategy than the employer thinks. Certainly the board thinks that salting campaigns have this developed strategy behind it.
Sometimes. I don't know what the board thinks as far as the merits are concerned. But all I'm suggesting to you is that if in fact you go to the compliance stage, and I want to ask a couple questions about that, but there's evidence introduced of some kind of grand plan that the union had, or the union itself refuses. We know it has a grand plan. It's all mapped out, and the union refuses to produce it. Well, then we know there are organizing plans, right?
Sure, but...
And we don't know that now.
Right, but the order from the board came down a year and a half ago. Mr. Couch had an interest in being put to work a year and a half ago, and that interest was refused. The fact that he may, at some distant point in the future, be given the job does not remedy the harm that he has not been given the job as of now.
Yeah. What is the extent of discovery that's permissible at the compliance stage?
Subpoenas on the union. In the first place, the general counsel would require the union to produce the information. And then the employer, in an adversary compliance procedure, would have the right to serve broad-ranging subpoenas on the union.
On the union.
Yeah.
So in cases before the change of presumption, when the burden was on the employer could subpoena the union for its organizing strategy and plans.
Yes, the union would be in a better position to say, we're not going to give you that information because it doesn't bear on the entitlement to back pay at this point. The employer might claim that it was being deprived of the chance to mount an affirmative defense.
At the compliance stage.
Right. The employer might be able to claim that it was deprived of the chance to mount an affirmative defense, but the position that I wish to make on the merits is that even under the board's former rule, even if the burden was placed on the employer to determine the remedy based on a reconstruction of party conduct during an organizing campaign that never happened because of the employer's violation, that commits the agency to engage in an inquiry that violates the rules laid down in cases like Shurtan and H.K. Porter. I am anxious. Sorry.
Principal basis for distinguishing that in the sense that here the board has already made its determination that the employer violated the statute. So the question is, what is the nature of the remedy? And that is, the details of that are to be worked out during the compliance proceeding.
That's not
like in the oil chemical situation.
But it makes very little difference to Michael Couch in the sense that as of a year and a half ago, the board said you're entitled to your job, but then the board in the rest of the order says not really.
The board said, surely we've got to read the order in its totality, right?
Correct.
To the extent that the board says you're entitled to your job, but the getting of it in a paragraph later or somewhere else says this is the way the proceeding will be on that. It's taken as a whole.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And that's why Michael Couch and the union are aggrieved as of the point that Michael Couch wants his job a year and a half ago. And it is an irreparable harm that he's not going to get that job until possibly sometime in the future, just as it was when the union couldn't get the information in oil, chemical, and atomic workers.
How is it irreparable? Because if he ultimately prevails, he'll get his back pay.
He's also unable to conduct the organizing that the board says that was part of his motivation for taking the job. Your Honor, I see that my time is running out. I was anxious to get to the merits of the argument, unless the court has further questions on aggrievement or rightness.
Yeah, why don't we come back to that?
Okay.
Trying to do this in sort of two parts.
Okay.
All right, we'll have you come back.
Okay. Are there any further questions on our position on aggrievement?
May it please the court, my name is Michael Stapp. I'm appearing on behalf of the Carpenters District Council. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I was going to address the merits, but given the questions asked of Mr. Anderson, I'm prepared to try and respond to those if you would prefer. Otherwise, I'll go on to the merits.
Why don't you address what we're concerned about?
Sure. Judge Rogers, let me go to the question you kind of asked at the end. I think kind of tied together some of the issues here. I don't think it's just the details here. It's more than just the details. What's happened in this particular case is the board has taken a long-standing burden of proof, abandoned that burden of proof, a burden of proof which, in my view, is contrary to even further long-standing burden of the wrongdoer doctrine, and now placed it upon us, the unions, or the general counsel, to litigate a case under the substantially different burden of proof.
Is it burden of proof or burden of production?
I think it's burden of production and proof.
Before the sheet metal oil case, who had the burden of proving the extent of back pay damages?
The initial burden of showing that there was some back pay goes to the general counsel. It always does. And then
it doesn't shift, right? But you had a presumption.
Correct. We had a presumption.
And the presumption, as a result of the presumption, the burden of going forward, the burden of production was really with the employer, because you could remain moot or mute, and if the employer didn't put any evidence on, you'd win.
That's correct.
Okay. So what we're talking about is the burden of producing evidence, right?
Right. And now we have to go forward with evidence at a time when we would not before. In addition to what Mr. Anderson said about the in-statement issue, it does, I believe, place a substantial burden on the union to disclose organizing tactics. And you asked earlier, I think, what evidence do we have of organizing tactics? I don't know what the evidence is in Mr. Anderson's case, but there's substantial evidence in my particular case. The discriminatees testified that they went through Comet training. And you also have to understand...
They went through training what?
Comet training on how to organize employers.
Yeah, but that's not the issue. It's how long they'd stay after either their organizational efforts succeeded or failed.
Well, that's the ultimate issue, but the board has said under Oil Capital and the operations management memos, which have come out since, we're going to look at a whole slew of things to make that determination. That includes your organizing plans, and not just your organizing plans with this particular employer. You're organizing plans with a whole lot of other employers.
So your presentation depends upon what it is the board allows into evidence?
No. It's not just what it allows into evidence. It's what the board's going to ask from us during the course of the investigation and what's going to be disclosed to the employer.
How do we know that until it happens?
Because Oil Capital says those issues are relevant. And if they're relevant, presumably the employer can lawfully subpoena them.
Well, presumably, yeah.
Well, you see, I mean, that everything you're saying tends to convince me it's not right, but because you're relying explicitly on statements of the board after the oil capital decision. You're talking about details of this proceeding, while what we appeared initially to have before us was a switch of the burden of coming forward and perhaps of the burden of persuasion. So,
and I clearly believe we
so
did.
Just completely underscores that the details of the proceeding itself are critical to your client, to your claim.
I think the burden of proof causes us to look at the details, and yes, that is critical to my client. It's critical to my client in terms of disclosing their organizing tactics with this particular employer and disclosing organizing tactics with all other employers they have to deal with. And that's something we're going to have to give to the employers if we end up in a trial over the matter because of this shift in burden of proof.
Well, the board responds and says maybe you won't. I mean, they come up with some hypotheticals as to how your clients might prevail even, not your clients, but the people you represent, might prevail even without disclosing what you characterize as trade secrets of union organizing plans.
But if you look at Oil Capital and you look at the things that they say are relevant and you look at the operations management memo that the general counsel's office has put out, which is attached to my brief,
just because the general counsel asks you for something, you're not obligated to turn it over, are you?
If they ask us for it and we don't turn it over, then they're going to tell us we didn't cooperate in the investigation and they're not going to issue a compliance specification.
No, I understand that hypothetical, but I was thinking of the hypothetical where you say it's not necessary to do that because we have other evidence.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, the board suggests in its brief that there may be other evidence that the general counsel can offer to support the back pay award other than showing organizing plans.
That's correct.
And the employer here argues that this has been going on for so long and everybody knows what's been going on, so we're not really talking about a great deal of secret strategy.
Well, my client certainly disagrees that it is secret strategy. I mean, collective bargaining has been going on in this country for excess of 70 years. That doesn't mean that a union's bargaining strategy is somehow no longer secret simply because we've been doing bargaining for years.
But let me just be clear that if this court were to hold that the challenge to what I'll call the board's rule is not right, and this matter went to a compliance proceeding, could not all of the arguments that you're making now be made there, and then the matter would come up in a factual context where it would be clear to the court that, in fact, in order to demonstrate entitlement, you would have to disclose the type of sensitive material you're talking about?
Well, it's a technical matter. What we have to decide as a union is, do we comply with the board's request and turn over the information? If we don't, then we're faced with the issue of the board dismissing and not issuing a compliance specification.
Well, what I was getting at is there's been a lot of discussion in the briefs about what protection could this information have before the compliance officer and ultimately before the board. And I gather, since this is a new rule, that maybe there would be new procedures, whether it's in camera, whether it's eyes only, those sorts of things.
But that doesn't do it any good once we end up in trial. At that point in time, the employer's going to have the information. Whatever in-camera protections.
No, but you would produce it only upon agreement that there'd be certain protections.
With the board, that's a possibility. But once we go to trial, after Oil Capital says this information's relevant, they're entitled to subpoena that. And then we're going to have to produce it at that point in time because Oil Capital says it's relevant. There's no getting around that.
And the type of protective order, you're saying that would, in other words, I just need to be clear that from your perspective, you're saying that there is no procedural mechanism that the board could come up with that could protect the sensitive data you're concerned about, given that the respondent would be entitled to see that information.
The only protection they can give us is during the investigatory stage, Your Honor. Once the investigatory stage is over, the compliance specifications issued, we tee it up for trial. The employer is then entitled to get a subpoena. They're entitled to subpoena anything that's relevant. My reading of Oil Capital, and I think the board's reading of Oil Capital, is those sensitive issues are relevant, and the employer would then be entitled to them. And that's what.
Let me ask you, following up on Judge Randolph's question, though, under the old rule, if we were dealing with assault, the employer could ask through a subpoena to get the union organizing plans, could it not?
You could get some materials. I would argue you could not get materials, for example, related to another organizing campaign. BCE is another case before the court. Mr. Jones at one time represented BCE. He also represents EPI. There are numerous other cases out there that the same employer's lawyer represents. We're going to have to cough up that information to those people. I'm just about out of all my time, and I'll reserve whatever I got left for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Jason Walta, appearing for the National Labor Relations Board.
I'm interested in the in-statement issue and also in the protection issue that I was just discussing with counsel. Can you address those two matters?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it is important to address at the outset that, contrary to what Mr. Anderson said, the board's orders prior to Oil Capital did not give a discriminatee an unqualified and an immediate right to instatement. The right to instatement has always been subject to a compliance proceeding, and the discriminatee could lose the right to instatement in that compliance proceeding. Just to give you an example, under the board's Dean General Contractors case, the employer could show in that subsequent compliance proceeding that it would not have retained the discriminatee at the end of a particular construction job, and that might have been pursuant to a particular policy or what have you, but that at that point, the right to instatement would be subject to the word the board uses is defeasance, and that the employee in that situation would not receive an immediate and unconditional right to instatement. So it's simply false to say that prior to the board's decision in Oil Capital, every instatement order was immediate and unconditional, and I think that may have been the concern that you had. I think the second concern that you raised was the subject of potential trade secrets and their disclosure at the hearing. And I want to just back up briefly to say that this is a purely academic discussion at this point. There is no indication in the extant record that trade secrets are at issue. Under this court's Sierra Club ruling, the petitioning union certainly had the opportunity to put in affidavits or some evidence that trade secrets might have been at issue. They did not. So at this point, any question about trade secrets being revealed in a compliance proceeding would be pure speculation.
Wait, you're talking about Sierra Club in terms of, in the opening brief, having affidavits to support standing?
To establish standing. And here the element of standing that we are challenging is whether they are presently injured or injured at all by the ruling under review. They may be injured in the board order that results from the compliance proceeding, and we don't discount the possibility that may happen. At the same time, if that proceeding goes swimmingly for the union and they receive the full extent of back pay and instatement they seek, there would be no injury. So at this point, any injury is purely speculative.
Could you lay out for us the procedures for protection of privileged material? Mr. Stapp made it sound as if some proceeding before trial at which all that is wrapped up, and that in the actual proceeding itself, by that time it's too late for the ALJ would be to make decisions on ways of balancing the interest in preserving privilege and getting the necessary facts.
Well, Your Honor, I first want to say that the board has actually recently, the board's general counsel, rather, has recently issued guidance on this very question. and it's in an operations and management memo. I believe it's 09-27, and I'll submit copies to the court pursuant to a 28J letter if you don't already have that. It's available on the board's website, and I'm sure enterprising law clerks can find it very quickly. But I will submit it in a 28J letter that sets forth what the general counsel proposes to do in these situations, which is that if there is a claim in an oil capital investigation that that certain union information is proprietary or secret or confidential, that will be held by the general counsel and not revealed to the employer, and that the union will then have an opportunity during the compliance proceeding in front of the ALJ to make arguments to the ALJ about what procedures, whether it's by protective order, filing things under seal, should be implemented during the compliance proceeding. I mean, this is not the first time in the history of law that trade secrets have been at issue in a litigation, and there are tried and true methods for protecting trade secrets without scuttling the entire litigation. And bear in mind, that's what...
Are you conceding that this is trade secret information?
I'm not. I'm acknowledging the possibility that it may be. At this point, the discussion is entirely academic. We do not know. Sometimes unions have been more than happy to reveal their organizing plans during the underlying unfair labor practice.
Has the board adopted the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure for discovery purposes?
What the board's rules say is that they should follow. No, I'm sorry. That's evidence. No, they have their own. They have their own procedural rules, and there are procedural rules for seeking discovery through subpoenas and things like that. But there is review built into all of those. And so if there is a claim,
I noticed in some of the papers that were filed, there were the pleadings going back and forth where the argument was about the meaning of the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure and whether, and then also Jenks Act questions about whether the statement of a particular witness had to be provided before the witness testified and everything. And it kind of looked to me like, and there were regulations cited, which I haven't checked, it looked to me like the board had adopted the federal rules.
They haven't adopted them wholesale. There are certainly things that they adopt by analogy, and there is a rule that incorporates the Jenks Act, so that statements made to the agency must be, revealed, particularly for purposes of cross-examination, and that is part of the board's rules. But as I say, there are methods that are tried and true for dealing with trade secrets if they are at issue, and I'm not conceding that they will be at issue, but I'm acknowledging that they might be at issue. But what the unions are proposing to do is to say, is to speculate at the possibility that there might be trade secrets at issue, and saying for that reason we should scuttle the entire inquiry. Without regard to whether the board can implement procedures that would protect those trade secrets, without regard to whether there might not be trade secrets at issue at all at a particular litigation. They're saying we should just scuttle the entire inquiry.
Am I correct in reading your brief, and I can ask respondent about its brief, that were this court to hold that the matter is not right now, and all of these concerns that the unions have raised were raised during the compliance proceedings, that the board would not be arguing that those matters had been waived?
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think that follows directly from this court's ruling in Tualatin Electric, and Judge Rogers, you were on that panel, and that case is in many ways the mirror image of the one you have there, the one you have here. In that case, the board had applied the presumption of continued employment to SALTS, and the employer was challenging it as an unreasonable interpretation of the act.
But I was also on a panel in a case called Scepter.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was where the employer, during the compliance proceeding, tried to raise an issue about the remedy, and the courts and the board refused to, saying that the court had already ordered enforcement of the board's order, which talked about a remedy. So I just want to be clear that we wouldn't be in that same situation here.
Well, Your Honor, there are a few things that would that distinguish that situation. First of all, we would be subject to judicial estoppel. If you adopted our argument, obviously we would be precluded from adopting that position later. But in any event, Scepter is distinguishable on a couple of grounds. First of all, that the relief at issue in that case wasn't subject to any further refinement in a compliance proceeding. And second of all, it was the case in Scepter that the employer raised it for the first time at all, even before the agency, in the compliance proceeding itself.
What do you mean it wasn't subject to any further refinement?
In the sense that in Scepter, I believe the case was that the employer, that the board's order set forth that the union would be able to elect remedies, and that its election of those remedies could result in a windfall. The fact of the election was apparent from the initial board order and wasn't subject to further refinement in a compliance proceeding where the board would say in that compliance proceeding, oh, you don't get to elect remedies in this case. Here we're talking about, as the court said in Tualatin, the amount of damages due. And we don't know what amount of damages will be due until we've finished a compliance proceeding, until that compliance proceeding has been adjudicated on a particular set of facts, which this court can then review in that concrete context instead of the academic context in which we're reviewing it here.
So you're reading the cases that deal specifically with back pay awards to cover in statement as well?
Yes, Your Honor, because the two go hand in hand. If your right to back pay is cut off for a particular reason, so too will the right to instatement.
Counsel, I think the Okaw case wasn't cited in the opening brief. What do you have any reaction to that?
This was the oil chemical workers.
Yeah.
Case where essentially instead of ordering a remedy, the board said, go forth and bargain and see if you can get the information outside of the board's processes. And that's what distinguishes that case from the one in front of you today. The board isn't saying, go see if you can get some back pay or instatement outside of the board's own processes and then come back to us. This is a case where the remedy is ordered by the board process, and that the only issue, or that the issue to be decided in compliance, is the extent of that remedy. And so it's distinguishable in that regard.
And so I'm clear. The union, particularly in the sheet metal workers' brief, distinguished between back pay and instatement. And the argument of agreement, in part, is that the remedy they sought was instatement without all these conditions about who has to come forward with the evidence, rather get in statement, it's presumed, unless the employer can show to the contrary. They say that just as in oil chemical, they asked for all this information, they didn't get it at all, so they were aggrieved. Why doesn't that follow here?
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't follow here because the instatement and the right to instatement is always subject to the compliance proceeding. That this is not a new situation. They aren't aggrieved. There's no additional burden on them now that wasn't on them before to participate in a compliance proceeding.
So let me just be clear. When counsel says here today that Mr. Couch would have had his job a year and a half ago, is that just an inaccurate statement, or am I misunderstanding what he's saying?
I think that it is a speculative statement, because even under the board's rule, if you had gone back and conducted a compliance proceeding under the previous rule, as this court recognized in Tualatin Electric, the employer could have come forward with evidence showing that he wouldn't have remained on the job because of the union's own policy, or even under the board's Dean General Contractors case, the employer could have come forth and said, yes, I would have hired him but for the discrimination, but he wouldn't have stayed on beyond the first construction job because I replaced my entire crew.
Mr. Couch, in fact, would not be placed in his job until the conclusion of that compliance.
That's correct. I mean, unless there were no dispute about it.
Right.
But assuming there were a dispute about whether he would have remained on the job, what his expected duration of employment would have been, that would have been a matter in dispute in the compliance proceeding. And the employer, under the Tualatin Electric case, could have come forward in an attempt to defeat the burden of the presumption of continued employment. Or he could have come forward and tried to prove that he wouldn't have remained past the first or the second construction job because he replaced the entire
group. Is this only applicable to the board's opinion is not written this way, but does this rule apply outside of the construction industry?
This rule, I think, is written. The board's rule applies to any instance of union salting, and I think the reasoning.
Why
industry is.
Right, and because I think the concern about the expected duration of the employee's tenure applies across industries.
And is there evidence that the organizer in the sheet metal workers case, for example, was being paid by the union?
He was a paid union organizer. Yes,
he was paid while he was employed.
He was paid. Well, he was never employed, but I believe the evidence was that he was paid and would continue to be because he
would continue to be paid if he had continued on the job.
Correct, Your Honor. And in the EPI case, it was that the employees who were salting would receive their wage from the employer, and then the union would supplement that up to the level of a union scale wage and union scale benefits. Now, I see that I've used more than my time talking about the standing issue. Should I go ahead and address the merits of the oil capital rule itself?
Well, very briefly, is there anything you'd like to add that isn't or emphasize that you haven't already addressed in your brief?
On the standing issue?
No, on the merits.
I don't think there's really anything that I'd like to add, but I would just like to stress two points if I can have the indulgence of the court. First, and these are both very broad principles. The first is that the agency under well-settled administrative law, including the Supreme Court's decision in Brandeis, the agency can change its mind, that the agency can overrule its prior rulings, even ones that have been approved by this court or even the Supreme Court, and that it can do so in response to change circumstances or even a change in administration. And second, and this is just a broad statement about the board's remedies, that the union's challenge misconceives the role of the board's remedies. The board's primary purpose is to stop and prevent unfair labor practices, and its power to order make-whole relief is largely incidental to that purpose. And make-whole relief is not intended as a punishment or a deterrent. It's meant to compensate the employee, and the measure of compensation is what the employee would have received but for the unlawful conduct. And this is not a case where the employer gets off scot-free for having discriminated against union salts. The employer is subject to a cease and desist order. If that cease and desist order is enforced by a court, as we're seeking in EPI, a violation of that order is going to be subject to contempt sanctions. There are other remedies in the board's order, including notice posting. And as the Supreme Court recognized in Hoffman Plastics, these remedies are sufficient to effectuate the purposes of the act.
The letter that's appended to the carpenter's brief, does that represent the board's view of what evidence is relevant?
Well, I think that the letter largely tracks what the board itself said in Oil Capital. And in Oil Capital, the board sets forth a list of evidence that may be relevant.
Maybe.
Correct, that may be relevant. I mean, there may be no union salting plans. Judge Randolph, you posited the situation where the extent of the plan was, let's get you hired and we'll wing it from there. In that situation, union salting plans might not really do a whole lot to advance the inquiry, and you might just look at, you know, the employer's, the union salt's own personal situation or try to define something from other salting campaigns conducted.
Let me ask you one other question about the carpenter's brief. Unlike the sheet metal works, they raise a retroactivity question.
They do, Your Honor. And in order to have retroactivity, there are a few things that you must show. You have to show, first of all, reliance on the existing law. And I think in this case, it simply can't be done. Allen Electric makes clear that this is a presumption, but a presumption that can be defeated. And that if the presumption is defeated, the union has to stand ready to put on its own evidence to rebut the employer's evidence.
As far as the propriety of the board, the case is not cited, but as far as the propriety of the board doing this through adjudication rather than rulemaking and therefore raising retroactive liability, the Supreme Court in Bell Aerospace crossed that bridge. I don't know why he didn't cite it, but.
Your Honor, I'm not sure why that is, that case didn't come up, but I will say that this isn't a case of retroactive liability. I mean, there's no imposition of retroactive liability because there's no liability imposed at all.
That's the case where the NLRB changes mind about whether buyers should be considered employees in industries throughout the United States, and as a result of the NLRB's decision, it was vast liability that was imposed retroactively. And the Second Circuit said the NLRB couldn't do it except through rulemaking, making it prospective only was the point. And the Supreme Court said, no, the NLRB can do it, make it retroactive.
And in this case, the supposed retroactive effect, I mean, there is no change in the behavior that they would have otherwise done. I mean, a reasonable litigant wouldn't throw all of his evidence in the dumpster and just count on the presumption carrying the day.
Well, we're talking about it's been 10 years, more than 10 years. One of the key salts has died. I mean, people have disappeared, et cetera. I mean, if you had known you would have this burden, you might have done something different with your records.
Well, Your Honor, but that's a problem that would be in existence even if this case were to go ahead under the previous rule. The employer might come forward with evidence that defeats the presumption, and the union is in the same, perhaps unfortunate, situation of not really having evidence contrary to that.
What's the explanation for that delay?
The delay, I don't have a good explanation for that, Your Honor, except that these are cases that have gone up and down, not just on this remedial question, but on the rules that would be required in the case in chief. The board came down with a ruling called FES that modified what the general counsel had to prove in any refusal to hire case. And so these cases, particularly the assaulting cases, have gone up and down for a variety of reasons.
So I'm clear. I mean, the parties make the point that this issue was never briefed or argued before the board came out with its rule. In the compliance proceeding, if the employee does not obtain what he seeks, and then there's an appeal from what, the compliance officer to an ALJ to the board?
Well, the compliance proceeding would be conducted in front of an ALJ, and then that order would go to the board, and then the board's order in that case would be appealable, yes.
Right.
And that in terms of the arguments being presented to the board, it didn't come up initially before the board, and the board issued its rulings. But the parties did fully ventilate their opinions on the matter in motions for reconsideration that were then ruled upon by the board. And unless there are any further questions, I thank you for the extra time.
Thank you.
And please, the court, Maurice Baskin, briefly for the employer interveners in this case. And we were constrained and uncertain, frankly, when the board raised this issue about standing and ripeness originally, because we very much want the board ruling on the merits to be upheld. But, frankly, we concluded that when employers have made the same type of arguments that the unions have made, the employers have routinely been told to wait until compliance and go through that process, and we cited a number of those types of cases in the briefs, and as a result concluded that there really was no choice but that the same result should happen here. I do want to reemphasize what was said about reinstatement. Does go hand in hand with the back pay issue. We're frankly quite surprised on reading the reply brief of the sheet metal workers to see that they were trying to treat them as two different things, because it was not evident in the original brief, and that's so totally contrary to board law. Employers, the reinstatement depends on whether the right to reinstatement has been told or wiped out in some way, and that's determining compliance. It may happen sooner. The employer may voluntarily offer reinstatement, usually in order to cut off back pay, but absent voluntariness, the so-called right of the union agent to be reinstated awaits the conclusion of the compliance proceeding. And so for all of those reasons and the reasons stated by the board counsel, the case really is not ripe. But if you were to reach it, I just wanted to emphasize that the union arguments that we saw in the briefs, and I suppose that we'll hear in the reply, are all based on a false premise, which is that SALTs are just like any other employees. They are not. They are temporary employees who have different community of interests, have been treated differently in many other respects, and the board has simply built up experience over many years now of the fact that SALTs are temporary and there should not be a fiction imposed, such as what the unions are trying to require the board to do here. All the board has done is to recognize, finally, much overdue, the realities of SALTing, the realities of the workplace, and we ask that you uphold the board order one way or the other. Thank you.
All right. Let's see, how do we want to proceed here with rebuttal counsel for Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, on the question of trade secret status for union organizing materials, you don't need to analyze this from the perspective of ordinary civil law. You can look at it through the lens of the National Labor Relations Act. The information that the board lists as the information that will be sought and extracted from unions is all information which, if obtained by employers in any other context, would constitute an unfair labor practice. And indeed, in the EPI case, you'll see that the board is actually asking this court for enforcement of an order against employer interrogation over those very subjects.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a great deal that happens in litigation before the board in terms of questions put to workers that would never, for a minute, I mean, this for 70 years, to echo what counsel said, this has been going on. Entirely different procedures before the board from procedures within a plant.
Well, ALJs will cut off
argument.
They will cut off questioning about protected concerted activity if it doesn't bear on an issue before the board. They won't allow employer counsel to use the cross-examination for that purpose. So the problem that we're confronting here is that the board is now
the materiality of the evidence being sought.
The board is now making that relevant and material. That's what renders us aggrieved, whether or not the court agrees with our position on the merits, because we have to pass through that process first. And it's true, as Judge Randolph points out, that under prior law, the employer could still elicit that information even though it had the burden of proof. But the essence of our petition for review is that even under prior law, the board was wrong if it thought that that kind of information was relevant to reconstruct the outcome of a labor dispute that had not happened. Quickly on Dean General Contractors, that was a case that involved a great number of applicants for a limited number of jobs within an employer that went job by job. However, I have to say that my understanding of the law is not the same as the board's counsel's. Normally, when the board, even in a construction case, orders reinstatement and back pay is an issue left for compliance, but the issue of instatement is a matter that the employer is under a present duty to deal with, even as the board issues its order.
If there were no presumption at all, how does that change your position?
Our position is that it's not relevant if the employer is asking the board to reconstruct what might have happened in the labor dispute.
But the general counsel then would have to prove how long, no presumption either side, how long the individual would have stayed on the job.
Right. Well,
and how's he going to do that?
One approach is the approach of the Fourth Circuit in Anaco, which is cited by the board as an anti-salting case, but it's actually quite good for the unions on standing. In Anaco,
I'm talking about the merits.
Okay, but on the merits, what the Fourth Circuit did in Anaco.
That case was decided after the compliance hearing.
Yes, but it depended on the unconditional immediate instatement of the SALT, because the Fourth Circuit looked at how long the SALT actually chose to remain in the job as the best measure of how long the SALT would have been on the job had he been hired years before. So to that extent, the Fourth Circuit's approach in Anaco presumes that you have instatement that precedes the back pay proceeding.
Go back to my question, though. If the burden remains on the union and the general counsel to prove the amount of, let's just talk about back pay,
yeah,
the amount of back pay, and there's no presumption either way, how does that change your situation? It doesn't. I don't see that it's any different. All the arguments you make, oh, the board can't go back and reconstruct events that never happened. Oh, my goodness, if we have to put this evidence on, it'll reveal
all kinds of secret information that the union possesses. All of that said, every argument that you make, it seems to me, would be exactly the same.
Except, I mean, the board can reconstruct events that didn't happen. The only events that are off limits to the board are the events of Section 7 activity. That is the interplay between labor and management. Because at the point that the board steps in to simulate how it thinks the parties would have behaved if there had been no unfair labor practice, the board's crossing a line that was drawn in Shorten and H.K. Porter.
Yeah, tell me what argument or what evidence, what evidentiary argument, for example, would be different if there were no presumption either way that you're making.
Well, if the SALT got in statement ahead of any back pay proceedings, the board could look at how long the SALT actually remained on the job, just as the Fourth Circuit recommended in Anico.
Suppose the SALT didn't.
If the SALT didn't remain on the job at all?
Right.
Well, then in that case, the employer would be able to point to that as evidence that the back pay should be limited to whatever time the SALT actually had worked.
Suppose it was not. No, suppose it's this case.
Yeah. Well, in this case, what we would say is that Michael Couch has always asked for his job, both when he applied for it and 11 years later when the board issued its ruling, and that it was within the employer's power to stop that back pay from running by offering him the job. If now they're looking at 11 years of back pay, the employer is really looking at a self-inflicted injury. The only way for the board to limit that period is to reconstruct party conduct in the labor dispute, which is something that they've never allowed the unions to do, so they shouldn't allow the employer to do it either.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Stapp?
I'm sorry. Judge Randolph, I'd kind of like to respond to a question you asked towards the end about what happens when there's no presumption. I have difficulty assuming that there is no presumption because the premise of that question means that we've thrown the wrongdoer doctrine out the window. Bigelow, 7-Up Bottling Company, a long series of cases. If you're the wrongdoer, then any uncertainty ought to be resolved against you. And that's a fundamental issue in this case, is the board has essentially, they've paid lip service to it in the oil capital decision, but they've essentially ignored it. Judge Williams, in response to one of your questions to Mr. Walsh.
It's typical in a tort case you have a wrongdoer if liability is established, but damages are a separate question. You don't presume damages. The person who's injured has to prove it.
Yes, but any uncertainty is resolved against the wrongdoer.
The question is, what do you mean by uncertainty in this particular situation? If the union had a policy, for example, if the union had a policy that SALTs remain under employment only for a year, no longer, then there's no uncertainty, right?
Correct.
Okay. So the question then is, what was the union, what evidence bears on that issue? And that, without a presumption, I'm right back where we are right now, you know, with the board situation as it is now under this case, the sheet metal workers case.
I think in my particular case, I think you can't separate the burden of proof and the wrongdoer doctrine. I have a difficulty doing that. Maybe I'm missing the point of your question. I'm sorry if I am.
Certainly to the extent that civil law is an example, you have a victim of a contract breach who can then, the victim is nonetheless subject to a duty to mitigate.
Correct. In fact,
I'm not sure why. I mean, it depends on details of the context, but it sounds as if what the board has done here is parallel to that.
Well, frankly, Your Honor, Bigelow and RKO, I believe, was a civil case. I believe it was an antitrust case involving a determination of how much money a theater might have lost because of what RKO had done. And the Supreme Court said, we have this doctrine. It's a long-established doctrine, the wrongdoer doctrine, that if uncertainty exists, then you make an assumption or a presumption against the wrongdoer. And I think oil capital's essentially thrown that out the window. I did also want to address an issue, Judge Williams, that you raised with Mr. Walter. He mentioned an operations management memo. He's correct. One has come out. But what he didn't get to telling you during his statement is that operations management memo only deals with the confidentiality of the information during the investigatory stage. We're still, all bets are off once we get to the trial.
You just made an argument for finding this unripe.
But we go to trial, Judge. We're faced with it. We have to go to trial at this particular point in time. Once they've conducted the investigation, we go to trial. We're not going to be back here. We're going to be going to trial. And then it's too late. The cat's out of the bag. And the concept that there is no trade secrets here, I think is preposterous given the board's definition of assault. They've defined somebody as assault as somebody that's engaged in this assaulting campaign. In my eyes, in my view, if you're engaged in a particular campaign, you've got a plan of action. And in fact, there's particular evidence in the EPI case of plans of action, testimony in those particular cases. I don't know how you fashion any sort of protective order that would ever keep information away from EPI.
You know of any cases in which take the most typical situation in trade secret law, that a former union employee disclosed to another what the typical organizational plan was of the union that employed him and was sued for the tort of disclosure of trade secrets?
I do not. What I was going to say is I don't know how you fashion any sort of protective order once we go to trial in this case that protects us from EPI getting all our organizing plans engaging in organizing with EPI. They're going to have it if it's relevant. And at that point in time, what the board has said is something very fundamental in this case. We're going to treat people who exercise a statutory right to assist, organize unions differently than people that merely join unions. And we're going to place those people under a different burden of proving their case, a burden which results in them disclosing information that certainly employers would not want to disclose to us in any other context. If no further questions, thank you.
Issue 2, Merits of the Unfair Labor Practices in Case Number 08-1081 and 08-1039. Mr. Jones for the petitioner, EPI Construction. Mr. Goldstein for the respondent, NLRB. Mr. Stapp. Mr. Stapp for the intervener, Carpenters District Council. Morning,
Judge. may it please the court, I'm Don Jones, representing EPI Exceptional Professional, Inc. This case calls for renewed vigor, and the economic times that we face, the difficulties we face at this time, calls for a renewed examination of Justice Felix Frankfurter's decision in Universal Camera versus NLRB.
I'm sorry, you're asking us to reconsider that?
No, just to take it into with renewed vigor that applies during these economic times. Thank you for helping me clarify that. And this court has of course followed that decision, and especially in the Detroit newspaper case that I cite, which also dealt with another issue that's been talked about today, the burden of proof. And the distinction between the burden of proof and the burden of production, which is, and I believe the judge ALJ in this case did not recognize fully the distinction between the burden of production and the burden of proof. There were several issues that I want to point out, points I want to make. The judge Craycraft stated, or ruled that two or three of our people that she called supervisors made statements that it would be futile for the union to organize, and that was unfair labor practice. Chairman Hertzian dissented on that point and said that's free speech protected by Section 8C of the Act. There was no threat in connection with that statement. And so that's an important point. In fact, Judge Craycraft has been reversed twice by the NLRB on that very point.
Well, let me ask you, in moving for reconsideration, did you object on the grounds that the board was not following a closely analogous case? I think it's the Jones case. In other words, did you, in objecting to the September 2001 decision, did you make that point that the board was veering from its closely analogous precedent?
I think we preserved all objections we did. When we filed our exceptions, we took the route of filing exceptions and a brief in support of exceptions, and we filed very comprehensive briefs. Now, some of the cases that Judge Craycraft was reversed on have come about since those objections. There's two cases that that were cited. Let's see, another point. Judge Craycraft cited the case of Winnett, W-I-N-N-E-T-T, Inc. That case is overruled by Parker-Rob Chevrolet, which is cited at page 9 in a quote from Touring Electric of page 9 of our reply brief. So that case is no longer the law. So if you look at this case in the light of Universal Camera, which requires looking at the whole record, not just part of the record. Now, for instance, there were four layoffs that were challenged, four layoffs, or two of them were suspensions, two layoffs and two suspensions that Justice Craycraft, they challenged. The four out of 24 layoffs, she looked at four, said, well, these four people have engaged in union activity, therefore the layoff that occurred shortly afterwards must have been as a result of union activity, must be discriminatory. She didn't look at the other 20 or 24 people that were laid off that were not involved in union activity. She didn't look at the whole record as required by a Universal Camera. I apologize for my Parkinson's. I have Parkinson's, and it causes me to shake a little bit once in a while. the two cases that she was reversed, Judge Craycraft was reversed on, were Weldon, Wilhau and Like Licht, 181 LRM 1008, I believe it is, and another case that came about, let's see, Parkinsave case, which
reversed
is...
Reversed on this issue?
Reversed on the issue of what is an 881 violation and on the futility, on the statement of futility. Now, one statement was made once they accused one of the alleged supervisors of saying that BCE had been infiltrated by a union and that Fred Stewart, the owner of EPI, was too smart to be infiltrated by a union. Well, I looked up the definition of infiltrate in the Black's Law Dictionary, and it connotes some activity of spying. If you're talking about spying, infiltrating, it sounds like the union would be trying to infiltrate management by putting people in management in supervisory positions to help organize the union. So infiltrate, just saying that Fred Stewart's too smart to be infiltrated, that is not a threat of any kind of wrongdoing on his part. So I think if you look at this case like Chief Chairman Hertzian did, 881, and if you look at the Universal Camera Doctrine, that this case should be reversed outright. Thank you. I'll reserve my time.
May May it please the court, my name is Stephen Goldstein, attorney for the National Labor Relations Board, which is seeking enforcement of its order against the company and which is opposing the union's petition for review.
Now, could you perhaps clarify whether or not the respondent raised this objection before the board that in ruling that a statement either by the president or by a supervisor about union activity would be futile was contrary to a recently rendered opinion, the Ross case. Was that objection raised?
I apologize. I was looking for the motion for reconsideration in the appendix, and apparently it's not in there. I just don't know the answer.
No, it's not in there, and that's why okay. I wondered if it had been raised or not. It's not in the record that we have right. of the case.
I just don't know, and I can certainly check after argument and inform the court in a post-argument letter. All the order denying the motion for reconsideration indicates is that the employer had challenged the board's failure to apply certain rules in determining whether applicants for employment were generally interested.
Now, counsel said he, respondent raised a lot of these things in his exception, so it may be there. It's just my speculation that it would have been
right.
in the motion.
Right.
So if you could let us know.
Sure, sure.
Thank you.
Now, the board found that the company violated the act by, among other things, making a variety of coercive remarks and by retaliating against employees and job applicants because of their union activity. And the question before the court with respect to the company's petition for review is whether substantial evidence supports each of the board's unfair labor practice findings. Now, substantial evidence supports the board's finding that the company laid off Allison and Piazza because of their union activity. The company certainly knew that they were union organizers as a result of Foreman Cerussi's unlawful interrogation of Allison in late July. The timing of the layoffs is suspicious because the company laid them off just 5 days after discovering the union activity, and the company's numerous unfair labor practices evidence its hostility to the union. Now, the company doesn't offer any substantive justification for laying off Allison and Piazza before this court. Instead, what it claims is there simply isn't any evidence of anti-union animus. For example, it argues that the board was precluded from finding that Mr. Cerussi interrogated Allison in late July because the unfair labor practice complaint did not allege that interrogation to be unlawful. But it's well settled that the board may find a violation which has not been alleged in the complaint if the violation is closely connected to the subject matter of the complaint and if the violation is fully and fairly litigated. And both of those prerequisites are satisfied here. The unfair labor practice complaint did allege that the company had interrogated employees. It did allege that Cerussi was a supervisor and an agent. And it also alleged that the company had laid off Allison and Piazza. And the July interrogation of Allison is relevant to the layoff allegation of Allison and Piazza because as a result of the interrogation, the company discovered their union activity, so that demonstrates knowledge, which is required to prove an unlawful layoff, and it also demonstrates animus. And this issue was also fully and fairly litigated. The only two individuals who were involved in the conversation testified. The company had the chance to cross-examine the union witness. The company had 4 months to prepare its defense, and when it called its own foreman as a witness, he admitted questioning the employee. And the company doesn't say that it would have litigated this case any differently had the matter been included in the complaint. Now, the company also complains that the board lacked authority under Section 10B of the Act to find that Cerussi violated the Act even earlier in April because the union's unfair labor practice charges alleged that the company's misconduct had occurred since July. However, Section 10B is not a straitjacket, and while the board doesn't have authority, carte blanche authority, to expand the charge however it may see fit, does have the authority to include matters in the complaint which were not explicitly alleged in the charge, so long as the complaint allegations are closely related to the charge allegations, and as long as the additional allegations occurred within 6 months.
This is Cerussi's statement about infiltration you're talking about?
Yes, and it's also a creation of the impression of surveillance in April as well. There were two statements that the board found were threats of futility, and one statement that created the impression of surveillance.
What in Cerussi's statement indicated that he meant that it was that Stewart would keep the union out by unlawful means?
Well, what he said in April was they were working at a job site, and a general contractor, a different entity, warned Cerussi that EPI should watch out because the union was out to get the contractors, and in the presence of an EPI employee, a statutory employee, Cerussi said that we don't have to worry about that. Fred, who was the Fred Stewart, the president of the company, is a lot smarter than that, and the union will never infiltrate EPI.
Yeah, so where is the evidence that he meant by unlawful means?
Well, this court.
Don't you have to establish that, by the way?
Excuse me?
You have to establish, to make out an 8A1 violation.
We have to establish that a remark could have a reasonable tendency to coerce employees. So that, in other words, that a reasonable employee could conclude.
Would take it as a statement that the employer was going to use unlawful means and
right.
therefore, you know, give up your organizing because he's going to defeat you one way or another.
Right.
Unlawfully.
Right.
Okay. So what I'm asking is, what is in Cerussi's remarks? What is there that?
Well, it's black letter law that in making that determination, the board doesn't consider the statement in isolation, but considers the statement in context. And the context doesn't just include the statements made at that precise time; it also includes statements made during the campaign. And what happened here was that just a couple weeks after making that statement, the very same supervisor and agent, Mr. Cerussi, told Allison and another employee that there was no way in hell the union would get in, and created the impression of surveillance by indicating that the company knew how many union guys were already working for the company. And then just a couple months after that, the company, the same individual, Mr. Cerussi, told one of the same listeners, Allison, that he promulgated a discriminatory note talking about the union rule. And then just a few days after that, Allison and Piazza were laid off. And so in context, the board was free to find that the statement could have a reasonable tendency to coerce employees. This case is much like the Federated Logistics case where an employer was found to have unlawfully threatened the futility of selecting the union by making comments about, you know, that if the union got in, there would be a strike. And the employer argued, much like your question suggests, well, standing alone, that's questionable. Why would an employee feel that the employer would unlawfully force the strike? And what this court pointed out was that the statement also occurred in the context of a whole series of other unfair labor practices. And judged against that comprehensive background, the statement could have a reasonable tendency to coerce. Now,
could you elaborate on why instituting the drug policy is discriminatory?
Sure.
I mean, the argument in the brief seems to be mainly a matter of timing. And I understand that in a context where, say, a worker is fired and there's ambiguity as to when the worker did this, when the worker did that, and if the timing is right after some sort of union activity, it makes sense to attribute it, the dismissal, to the union activity. But that firing someone is firing someone is always bad, right? Is that's it? I don't mean illegal. It's always bad for the person who's fired, right? Is imposition of a drug policy in the same category?
Well, this was a random drug testing policy. It wasn't a policy allowing for drug testing for cause. And you know, one need only read the newspapers.
Is there something in board law on that?
No, the board doesn't sit as a super personnel manager, you know, judging the propriety of employer work rules. But notwithstanding that bedrock principle of law, nevertheless, an employer does violate the act if it promulgates work rules in response to a union campaign. When a union tries to organize an employer has to act as if the union is not there in terms of promulgating work rules. If it has a legitimate business justification for doing it, it can do it, whether the board or employees think it's unfair or unwise or whatever. But here, this employer has been in business for many years. It's undisputed that it did not have a written drug and alcohol testing policy prior to the union drive.
The argument that the employer notified the union that it was about to institute this policy and the union said it had no problem with this?
Well, that simply is inaccurate. The employer did notify the union that it was about to institute the policy, but it did not say that if the union voiced objections, it would hold off. What it told the union was, is we're not going to bargain with you. We welcome your response, but we're not going to bargain with you. And the union obviously had a problem with it because they filed an unfair labor practice charge about the institution of the drug testing policy. And we don't just have the timing that it comes a mere 2 weeks after the union informed the company that it had already successfully planted salts in the company's workforce. But we also have the fact that the company is utterly unable to explain a reason for why it promulgated the policy when it did. It argues that, well, we did it because we wanted to be able to bid on federal jobs. But the company's president admitted that he had been able to bid on federal jobs despite not having the policy, and he had been doing so for more than a year. So the company certainly failed to show that it would have done it anyway. It also claims that it did it because it was working on another, on a particular job site where another entity's employee had died. That death occurred in January, some 7 months before the union sent salts to the company. The company took no actions until 2 weeks after the union informed the company that that it had successfully planted salts in the workforce. And so under the deferential standard of review that the court is obligated to apply, we respectfully submit that the board's determination is reasonable. And if I may just make one comment, while today's economic circumstances are certainly daunting, it's important to remember that the National Labor Relations Act was passed during a time of even greater economic uncertainty during the Great Depression. In conclusion, the board respectfully requests that the court enforce the board's order and deny the union's petition for review. Thank you very much.
Mr. Staff for intervener.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the record in this case amply supports a conclusion that this employer is willing to use information of union activity to repeatedly violate the act. I would urge you not to give them a chance to do that again. I think that Mr. Goldstein has more than adequately presented the case, and if you have no questions for me, I will defer the rest of my time.
Thank you.
A couple of points that I want to be sure to have made, that the drug policy, I believe, the testimony, as I recall, we did notify the union that we wanted to have a drug policy in effect. It is important. If you can bid on federal jobs, but if you get the bid, I don't think our client had bid on job. I think the client had bid on jobs before, but had not been successful on bids, and had not actually entered into a contract to do a federal project. If he had entered into a contract to do a federal project, he would have had to have the drug policy in effect at that time. So this was looking forward to hopefully winning one of those bids that he had not won in the past. Also, it did have a lot to do with this death that occurred to an employee of another company, Midwest Drywall Company, which had an employee that worked on the same job with this client doing similar type work. And this employee walked off the top of a machine and killed and died on the job. And OSHA cited that company, the Occupational Safety and Health Commission, cited that company for not having adequate policies in effect, and not specifically for not having proof that they had trained this worker on fall protection and other OSHA issues, safe job safety issues. And that gets into the...
Refresh my memory, what did the NLRB say about that evidence?
The NLRB ignored that evidence, as best I recall. I don't believe they even acknowledged that the evidence was presented, or at least didn't pay much attention to it. Especially when we had 16 people, the 10 salt applicants, and six other people, four layoffs and two suspensions. 16 people that the labor board was suing my client for discriminating against. So I think it's in evidence that I asked the client to have you got 16 jobs we can offer them? No. I said, have you done the safety training that Midwest Drywall was cited for not having, was fined by the OSHA for not having done ahead of time? No. I said, I would suggest you do at least 2 hours training for all of your employees on job safety, get an expert in to train them, and we'll offer all these 16 people 2 hours of paid time if they will come in for safety training, and we will guarantee them the next available job openings you have. And that's what we did. This not only is what we wanted to do, this is what federal law requires us to do, every employer to do, have the job training, safety training before they go to work. So we did that, and Judge Mary Craycraft said that was an improper condition on reinstatement, which that should be reversed, because she's really told us that we should violate the Occupational Safety and Health Act. We should put people to work without job training, safety training ahead of time, jeopardize lives and safety. So the drug policy is part of that same consideration for safety. That employee that walked off the top of that machine, they did an autopsy on him, and I think that was in evidence also. The safety expert, Lee Johnson, testified. He had drugs in his system, that guy. So that did have a lot to do with our drug policy. And at the hearing, James Carcell, the union organizer, was asked if he had any objection to this drug policy. He said, no, it's a good thing. We're for it. Every one of your contractors has a drug policy? Yes, they do. Is there anything wrong with this drug policy? No, I don't see anything wrong with it. He testified to that at trial. So the drug policy, that certainly was. Now, then the other thing is the Rutgers. I see red time is up. I want to make one more point, if I may. The two people that they say that we shouldn't have hired is Greg Rucker, a brother of Randy Rucker, who was a union supporter, and a brother of Joe Rucker, who was an employee, and Stephen Rucker, who's the son of Randy Rucker, who's a union supporter. And Randy asked the company, he said, my son is going into the military. He's got 60 days between now and the time he has to report for duty. Could you get him a job? Could you offer him a job? So they created a 60-day job for this young man out of a motive of patriotism. And Judge Mary Craycraft has said that was unlawful to have patriotism to hire him because he was less qualified than some of the job applicants. But he wasn't hired as a carpenter. He was hired as a laborer. They say, well, he was paid carpenter rate. They do school projects which have prevailing wage rates. If a laborer touches a board during any part of a day, the prevailing wage people will say you got to pay carpenter's rate. So they paid the carpenter's rate a day or so to avoid problems like that. But he was hired as a laborer. And Greg Rucker, they said in one place, they say he was overqualified because he had been in management for his last employer. But then after remand, he comes back and Judge Craycraft says, well, he wasn't as well qualified as the union batch applicants, therefore you shouldn't have hired him. So there's inconsistent findings. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. We will take the cases under advisement.